Family, this is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The situation in Ukraine is changing by the minute. Secretary of State John Kerry is on his way to the capital of Kiev to show U.S. support for the country's new government. That's after Russia sent 16,000 troops into and around Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Russian President Vladimir Putin says his goal is to protect his country's interests and the Russian-speaking citizens in Crimea. But over the weekend, President Obama warned Putin against continuing this military action.
Just days after the world came to Russia for the Olympic Games, it would invite the condemnation of nations around the world. And indeed, the United States will stand with the international community in affirming that there will be costs for any military intervention in Ukraine.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Americans in New Hampshire have been heartsick over what's happening in their native land and are sorting through their own feelings about what they want America to do. Today in The Exchange, Granite Staters reflect on the situation in Ukraine. Let's hear from you this hour. Do you have ties to Ukraine, whether through family or work or friends? What do you make of Russia's actions? And how should the U.S. and others react? How do you think these tensions may affect the geopolitics of Europe? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. With me in studio is Al Baymar. He's a software engineering manager in Nashua. He's originally from a town in eastern Ukraine. His wife is from western Ukraine, which identifies more closely with Europe. And Al, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Nice to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dmitry Goryanov. He's also a software engineer in Nashua. He emigrated from eastern Ukraine in 1999, still has family there. And Dmitry, thank you for making time out for us today.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Also with us, Colonel Lionel Ingram, a lecturer in political science and foreign policy at UNH, including U.S.-Russia relations. He served for 30 years in the U.S. Army, including NATO tours with the Secretary of Defense Office. And Colonel Ingram, welcome back. Good to see you.
My pleasure.
And joining us from Hanover is Yulia Komska, assistant professor of German at Dartmouth College. She's from western Ukraine. Her first book, The Iron Curtain, The Cold War's Quiet Border, will be released in December of this year. And Professor Komska, good to have you. Thank you also for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And I want to start with you, Professor Komska, and just start with some real basics before we get into what's happening right now. Just remind us how long, Professor Komska, Ukraine has been its own country, not part of the Soviet Union, but Ukraine, an independent nation.
Of course. Ukraine became independent in August 1999. And to just give you a sense of the historical events, the Soviet Union fell apart in December of that year. However, this was not the first time Ukraine was independent. There was a short-lived Ukrainian state between 1917 and 18. Other than that, however, the country was under the influence of a variety of different powers over time: Ottoman Empire, Austria-Hungary, eventually Poland, and Russia, which in part explains the kind of divisions that we've been hearing about a lot, although these divisions, I would suggest or argue, were being overcome by a lot of protesters in Kiev and other cities around Ukraine.
And where is this region in dispute, Professor Komska? Crimea. Why is Russia so interested in this?
Crimea is a pivotal access point to the Black Sea, which is a very significant fleet site. A Russian fleet is based in one of Crimean cities. Crimea itself is also a top resort destination and prime vacation land. It is not originally either Russia's or Ukraine's. Catherine the Great in the 18th century colonized it for Russia, and Nikita Khrushchev gave it over to Ukraine in the early 50s in a gesture of brotherly love to celebrate a tricentennial anniversary of signing a particular treaty between Ukraine and Russia.
So the Black Sea area, that's where we all watched the Sochi Olympics just recently.
Exactly. So, and the ethnic population of Crimea is Crimean Tatars, who have had a very difficult destiny that I will not recapitulate here. But the bottom line is that during the Second World War, many of them, or most of them, were deported by Stalin as a potential six-column a kind of a treacherous minority.
Wow.
So since then, they've come back and settled. And right now, they're saying that they would like to stay with independent Ukraine and not return back to Russia. So this is another added part in the complicated Russia-Ukraine equation.
Well, and by the way, if you want to see maps of the region that we're talking about, both Ukraine and Crimea, you can go to our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We put a couple maps up there. Again, our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, to see maps of the area that we're talking about this hour. And so, Colonel Ingram, to you, so what's the American interest in this?
Well, not nearly as strong as the Russian interest. Let me talk about the Russian interests, if I may. Let's talk about it in terms of threat and opportunity. If the Ukraine were to go towards the West, Russia's going to have a problem in terms of pride. They're going to have a problem in terms of their attitude towards what they consider the near abroad, the 14 former republics of the Soviet Union. You might want to discount the three Baltic states. And it's also it could be an impact, a serious impact upon what they've held for years to be a buffer between the West and themselves. So there's a threat there, and there's a response coming from the Russians because of the threat, and also because what they would like to see, or the Russians would like to see, in terms of how to bring together all 15 or maybe the all 12 former republics. Then there's an opportunity. All of a sudden, they've got this problem in their hands. Maybe this is the time they can solve the problem for them in terms of the Ukraine.
And the problem being the toppling of this pro-Russian president,
ma'am.
Yanukovych, and the bringing in, I don't want to say election, but the bringing in of a government seen as more pro-Western. That's the problem that Russia faces.
That's the problem, the threat, as I think they perceive it. And then there's also the opportunity. If we can take advantage of this, not only do we want to push back in that direction, I have no idea what the Russian goals are. I can just imagine their set of goals they're working with. But it appears that we've discussed that very likely the minimum goal is going to be a sense of a greater control of the Crimea.
What about America, though? If I asked you, so why should America even care about this?
Well, I think we care because we have an attitude we do not like to see other countries being taken over by a larger, bigger country. And this is a threat to how we perceive the world ought to operate. There's also a threat to the relationships of the world. We've been dealing hands back with Russia, but on the other hand, they were to some degree a partners in things that are very important to us. Having done it in a forceful fashion, it disrupts the relationships that we'd like to see. So it's less that we have a particular relationship with the Ukraine or with the Crimea. They fit into a bigger picture of how we'd like to see the world work.
Got it. And Dmitry, your broad reaction to what's going on, and then I'd love to hear from you as well what you're hearing from friends, family, contacts in Ukraine. But just broadly, what do you think of this?
Well, first of all, I'm worried about that my family, they live in eastern part of Ukraine. And it's
near the Russian border.
Yes, near the Russian border. And just right now, it's like an unreported rumor that Russia accumulates more forces along that part of border. And it just that region, my family, maybe like my city when I lived my first half of my life, it might be next on the menu.
Wow.
And I haven't been following Ukrainian politics much till the last few months, when all of a sudden it became important and even more important for me, like last few days. So I'm talking about to my friends, family who's there, and their reaction is like very different, surprisingly for me. Some just dismiss it as it's not going to happen, and they're not taking it seriously. Some thinking, yes, even if it happens, if Russia moves in, so what? We wouldn't have much problems. I think this part of people, they just don't realize all the consequences it might be.
Do you think they're more worried? I mean, excuse me, you're more worried about it than they are?
For some people, yes, surprisingly. And I don't try to convince anybody there except my immediate family when we even discuss sometimes immediate steps what we probably can gonna do in this case. But because I live in United States for like the last 15 years, I don't know very close. I haven't been in Ukraine for a long time, so my perspective might be very different from they. But in terms of Russia moving in, trying to overtake the region, that worries me. And it worries me as a Ukrainian who has still family there, and worries me as American, because consequences of what's going on right now, and if United States and the Western world put up with this and let Russia do it, it will have like big consequences for United States.
Yeah, and I definitely want to ask all of you about what you said, Dmitry, let Russia do it, because that's being talked about a lot.
Yeah, and I've read in comments on Ukrainian, on United States message boards, and people saying, oh, it's Ukraine-Russia problems. So let them sort this out. And I just want to scream, no, it's not. It's going to be consequences for all of us.
Al, what's going through your mind with all this news?
I wanted to follow up on that point. I think in no way is it just a problem between Russia and Ukraine. We can probably start with the Budapest Memorandum, which was signed back in 1994. And according to that memorandum, the agreement was that Ukraine is going to give up on its nuclear weapons. Now, in exchange, the Great Britain, the United States, and Russia would make sure that the sovereignty of Ukraine isn't going to go anywhere.
That's right. I remember that. Ukraine agreed to give up nuclear weapons in exchange for its sovereignty. You're absolutely right.
Right. So what we are seeing at this point is that it's just been broken. Now, if I'm a third party, if I'm a country somewhere in Asia and I'm looking at what's going on, I would think, okay, not having the nuclear weapon is a bad thing. You shouldn't exchange it for a piece of paper. You should have it. That's one of the points.
We will definitely follow up after a break, get more of your thoughts and feelings. And I also want to return to the idea of what America should do. We'll also take your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR is trying to keep our upcoming March fund drive as brief as possible, which is why on day one of the drive, we're planning to raise the entire day's goal in just 4 hours. Your donation now will count toward the tally and help us collect $10,000 in challenge money. Support the news service you love at nhpr.org. More on Granite Stater's reaction to the situation in Ukraine on The Exchange. And at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, we'll get an update on the crisis in Ukraine. Sunshine this morning, clouding up this afternoon with high temperatures today in the low to mid-20s. Cloudy tonight, chance of evening snow showers for the North Country. Lows single numbers north, ranging teens south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Coffee Company, providing businesses freshly filtered water with the Ion water cooler and single-serving, environmentally friendly coffee pods. NHCoffee.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the tensions in Ukraine and getting thoughts from Granite Staters with ties to the region. We invite you to join us now with your questions and comments. If you have ties to Ukraine through work or friends or family, what do you make of Russia's recent actions there? How do you think the U.S. and other countries should react? Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. By the way, if you want to see maps of the region that we're talking about, you can go to NHPR Exchange, our Facebook page, and see some of the maps of the places that we're talking about. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Komska, I want to return to you, please. You know, putting again what Vladimir Putin has done just in the past couple days, sending troops into Crimea. How are we to sort all this out, Professor Komska? I mean, you had all these protests in Ukraine. Those were the top of the news for a couple of days. Then the government's pushed out about, gosh, a week ago, maybe even less. Then a new one comes in. then the Crimea situation. I mean, it almost gives you whiplash, Professor Komska. How are we to sort this all out?
Well, I think that the Crimean situation was in many respects not really expected by a lot of Ukrainians. I think that Ukrainians have tried to really consolidate the nation, and I think that that's where the protests have been very different from the previous 20 years of divisions in Ukraine. The protests really have come up with, even though, and I should probably footnote that, even though the opposition probably did not exist as a monolith, it was a consolidation of a variety of political parties and movements, what they really tried to do is come up with a unified vision, with a unified strategy for where Ukraine should go in the future, and if anything, bridge the divisions that have been taking place. The Crimean situation has, I think, eroded, or Russia's intervention in Crimea was perhaps even a conscious erosion of the pattern to bridge the divisions, and probably planted additional seeds that could sow discord between the Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers in Ukraine. So the Russian speakers are typically in the south and east of Ukraine, and most Ukrainian speakers are in central and western Ukraine. And a lot of that has been done by giving Russian passports, Russian citizenships to more than 140,000 Ukrainian citizens who can now claim that they are Russian subjects and feel that they're under attack by the state.
And Professor Komska, asking you more now, not as a professor, but more as someone who is originally from Ukraine, what did you make of Dmitry's comment that when he hears, you know, other people say, look, just let Russia do it, it's not our business, he said he wants to scream, he finds that very frustrating. How do you feel about that? What do you think other countries, including this one, should do, if anything?
Well, I feel that there are two things that perhaps need to be done. A, I think that we should hope with the Ukrainians. I think a lot of the narratives that dominate the American press are the narratives of despair. Ukraine is portrayed as a divided, dysfunctional state where fascist bands roam around instead of portraying the progress that the events in Kyiv have made. So that's on the one hand, and sort of putting out a more redemptive, positive narrative of what the protests have actually accomplished. On the other hand, I think there is a number of voices coming from Ukraine that have been clamoring from the very beginning of the protests that the West, Europe in particular, but also the United States, should try and acknowledge the fact that Ukrainians may well have been the first contingent in Europe to be willing to shed blood for European ideals and ideas, and go out into the streets and protest most vocally. And I don't think they have gotten that message. And that, I believe, has made many of them feel abandoned and disappointed. And I think that for myself, I have been quite disappointed too.
In Europe, in America, or both?
In the West, probably writ large, especially at the time when the West is not seen by many as a truly great thing. So here we have the fans of the West who are going out there for Western ideas, but also just more vaguely for freedom and liberty wherever they're located. And I don't know that they're getting as much credit as they should.
Well, it's interesting, and we were just looking at some of the news this morning, Al, and the White House is preparing a big package of sanctions, consequences, diplomatic, economic. And the Obama administration's trying to convince Europe to go along, and Europe's kind of saying, no, I don't think we really want to do that. I'm wondering if you share the disappointment that Professor Komska has.
Yeah, I agree with that point. It's indeed a shame. Just yesterday I saw that leak in The Guardian about United Kingdom seeking to ensure that Russian sanctions do not harm City of London. That's one thing. The other thing, just yesterday, Frank-Walter Steinmeier was mentioned that Germany got to be against the sanctions. Not sure why, but that's the point. You know, it's been contrasting so much with that great speech of the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations power. That really felt like finally the United States are doing something, and they got to be doing something at this situation. From my understanding, there's no way that Putin can be negotiated with in the normal manner as usually Western countries do. Why? Because he pretty much shares no values with the Western world, values such as dignity or human rights, human life itself. There are only two buttons, greed and fear, right? Those are two emotions which Putin understands. And unless you are pushing one of those two buttons, or perhaps both of those, there's no way you are going to have him negotiating on anything. So from my understanding, it's just money and firm force which got to be used as the leverage for applying the leverage. And I'm really glad that finally the United States started understanding that.
What do you think, Dmitry? From the New York Times, I'm reading here, the Obama administration suspended military ties to Russia, including exercises, meetings, calling off trade talks. Officials said they would ban visas, freeze assets of selected Russian officials, target state-run financial institutions. Congress says, yes, it'll go along with this, and approve economic aid for the new government in Ukraine. But the New York Times says, by itself, the United States is not even among Russia's top 10 trading partners, no more than $40 billion in exports and imports. By contrast, Europe does about $460 billion in business with Russia, giving it far more potential clout, but also exposing it to far more risk. I wonder just what you make of what the U.S. is trying to do, what Russia is trying to do, and whether it will really make a difference.
Unfortunately, I think Russian government calculated this move. They moved pretty carefully, and they knew where United States and Europe gonna stop. They knew for sure it's gonna be no military action, and they knew that all the sanctions probably gonna stop short at where it really started to get hurt them. There's going to be no serious trade consequences, gas and oil still going to flow, money for this still going to flow back to Europe, and they just decided, okay, we can probably live with all those sanctions they're going to impose on us. I hope I'm wrong, and sanctions going to be enough for to push back all the hardliners around Putin, who, if it hurts them personally, when they cannot travel, when they have problems sending their families, their kids abroad, when their assets are in trouble and suddenly very close looked at, then they might be a chance to solve it. And it's probably going to be a long process. They won't withdraw immediately.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We welcome your questions, comments, thoughts about the situation in Ukraine. We're sitting down with a panel of Granite Staters who have ties to the country and inviting your comments at 1-800-892-6477. Waiting in Nashua is John. Hi, John. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey there. I was calling. I hate to detract from the conversation about geopolitics, but I was wondering about how the ethnic tensions might be playing out, particularly in Crimea. And I'm worried that maybe your guests might not have too much firsthand experience, but I wanted to ask about the Crimean Tatars in particular. I'm an ethnic Turk, so gotta watch out for my cousins. And I know that, you know, they've had a difficult time under the Soviets, and they're kind of apart from everybody in Ukraine. And I was wondering how they and possibly other ethnic minorities might be getting affected by what's going on, both in Ukraine as a whole, but also specifically in Crimea, where Russia is asserting its muscle.
Okay, John, thanks for the call. Professor Komska, can you handle that, the fate of ethnic minorities in Crimea?
Yes, I could certainly start. So I think some of the images that we've been seeing in the press were those of Crimean Tatars, and in particular a lot of mothers of Crimean Tatars. Some of them were in the Ukrainian military forces, putting themselves between Russian troops and Ukrainians, trying to avert a confrontation. So I think a lot of their deputies have been barred from participating in Crimean parliament. So Crimea has a partial autonomy, and they have their own parliament in which the Tatars are represented. A lot of them have not been able to participate in the regular workings of the parliament since March 1st, when the Russian troops first found their ways into Crimea. But, I mean, in terms of other minorities, of course, you can talk about Jews. There have been a lot of, and I am myself part Jewish, and there have been a lot of discussions about the far-right parties and fascist parties dominating the discourse, and that a lot of that has been coming from the Russian press and Russian propaganda. Indeed, there are fascist parties in Ukraine. There are fascist parties in most European countries. There is a European alliance of fascist parties. France's fascist parties are garnering about 20% of the vote, so they're always the ones to watch out. However, they're not necessarily dominant. And Jews, while fearful for the changes and what they might bring for them, were also absolutely integral to participating in the protests. They were out there on the barricades with everyone else. And in countries, in cities like Lviv, my hometown, they 100% support Ukraine. So that's something that I could add to.
Well, John, thank you for the call. And here's an email somewhat related to something you raised, Professor Komska. This is from Ralph in Hanover. He says, it concerns me that there's been little, if any, discussion and evaluation of the present Ukrainian interim government, which America appears to be backing without reservation. Ralph says, many of these individuals, I'm going to throw this to you, Colonel Ingram, many of these individuals have questionable backgrounds and far-right political affiliations. Would this be a good idea before America becomes further entangled in this situation? Ralph, thank you for the question. And I do wonder, Colonel Ingram, you know, this new government's only been in for a couple days. Is the U.S. rushing in too quickly to support these folks?
I'm not sure if it's to support the people. I think one of the questions, that government, one of the questions is been raised here is how should we support Ukraine, the population of Ukraine? Of
the
course,
people.
It's a mixed population, too. And this is critical. If we're going to do anything, most likely it's going to be a matter of how we help them move from where they are now to a pretty unpopular government, to a government which can be better. Maybe the vote in, what is it, 23rd of May?
25th.
Okay. When they vote, have a presidential vote, when they eventually come around and try to recreate the parliament.
So this is an interim situation.
This is an
interim situation.
In May. Okay. It's, at least they have some form that they can work with. It's going to be very difficult to make arrangements, agreements with them because they're not going to be around very long. But you work through them to the larger population. I don't think you should be terribly concerned about the fact that there are all sorts of left, right, and center groups there. There's a population in Ukraine which needs to be supported. And that's the fundamental thing we can do. If we can't handle, for a variety of reasons, or seem to be unable to handle well dealing directly with Russia, we can deal directly with or fairly closely with the people of Ukraine.
We've talked somewhat this hour about what folks want America to do in particular, since here we are in the U.S. And Al, I haven't asked you yet what your contacts in Ukraine are saying about what they want this country to do.
Well, I have many friends there, and one clear point that they're making at this time is that for 23 years they lived there as an independent country and not a drop of blood has been shed. Now it's very different. And what I hear is a lot of anger, a lot of disappointment with what's going on. It just sounds like there's no way that this country is going to be invaded with no consequences. For all the bad stuff that Yanukovych and Putin did to Ukraine, they did one really great thing. They allowed the people of Ukraine unite.
Because people are so angry about this.
That's how angry they are. And even though this government, this interim government that they're currently having, is extremely unpopular, I think to a point it's been a blessing for this unpopular government that the current situation allowed all the people unite around them just in case to in order to deal with this large problem of the foreign aggressor attacking the country.
Dmitry, what does your family in Ukraine want the outside world, especially the United States, to do? And it was interesting earlier you said you, in some way, were more worried than they were about Russian aggression, so to speak. But what do they want America to do, Europe to do?
Well, right now, I'm not sure I can speak for them because the last time I talked to them a couple of days ago, they asked me about what do you think they should do. what I told them, and they pretty much agreed with me, that whatever happened in Ukraine, it can be handled internally. I also had my reservation about some forces that started, that were like driving forces during this revolution, during the ousting of President Yanukovych, but so far some of my fear proven to be wrong. Nobody tries to grab power and just establish another dictatorship.
So you had some concerns, like our emailer, about the new folks
in
power.
Yes, and so far they had their political view, but they play on the rules. They don't try to force those views on anybody else. They just try to convince people. And yes, people allowed to have different political views. But in terms of Russian invasion, I think that everybody should agree that this should end first, and Ukraine can handle its own problems. That's pretty much almost all people who I talk to, they agree with this. They have different views inside the country. Some of them completely pro-Western, some of them pro-Russian, but they think this invasion should stop.
We will talk more in just a moment. More conversation with a roundtable of Granite Staters with ties to Ukraine coming up in just a moment. And your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. It's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, update on the crisis in Ukraine. Threat of further Russian military actions ramps up pressure on Ukraine. The latest on the situation in Ukraine and Crimea. Then, for this month's Environmental Outlook, new strategies for stopping the elephant ivory trade. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, sunshine for this morning, clouding up this afternoon with highs today from the low to mid-20s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Geriatric Psychiatry Services at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, specializing in mental and behavioral health for people 65 and older in outpatient or inpatient settings. FrisbeeHospital.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the crisis in Ukraine and getting thoughts from Granite Staters with ties to the region. We invite you to join us with your thoughts, questions, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. By the way, there you can also find a map of the region we're discussing this hour. The number again, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. And Don's waiting in Concord. Hi, Don. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
I was calling. I actually monitor elections for a living for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
Wow.
So I monitored the election where Yanukovych beat Timoshenko. And we have to remember that at that election, the international community being the observers, we determined that although the election had problems, it was a legitimate election, and the will of the people was that Yanukovych be the president. And I don't know how that bodes for the election coming up on May 25th, where my organization will also go and observe, and whether the eastern part of the country, which is the question I have, will go along with the election, or are they simply going to say, no, we still recognize Yanukovych, we're the Russian part of the country, and we're not going to have an election on May 25th for a new president.
Wow. Well, it's fascinating to hear from you, Don. So you were there. How long ago was that again? Remind me.
4 years ago.
Okay. And you folks determined that that was a legitimate election.
Yeah, I was the legal advisor for the mission. This organization, America Belongs, we even monitor American elections, but they monitor elections mostly in the former Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. I'm going to Macedonia tonight, actually, to monitor an election in Macedonia that's happening in April. And as part of that, we release a report, and the issue there was Yanukovych won by 2 million votes. Tymoshenko challenged it, but we determined, and especially as the lawyer, I determined that even if she proved all the fraud that happened, he still was going to win because he had such a big lead. So our conclusion to the international community was he's legitimately elected. Yeah, there was a little bit of fraud, there were problems, but in the end, the will of the people is what happened.
So what do you make, given your experience, Don, and this is really interesting, what do you make of what's happened there now?
Well, you know, I've been meaning to look at the constitution of Ukraine to find out the issue of whether Tymoshenko can run, because she says she was going to, but there was a provision about convicted felons running for office, so I don't know whether they pardoned her. It depends on what they did. And the real issue is going to be whether the eastern part of the country is simply going to say, no, sorry, but this is not a legitimate election. We have a president. And then what do the Americans do? Because we base a lot of our aid on what my organization says about whether an election is democratic and whether it was fair.
Well, Don, have a good trip to Macedonia. And I'm really glad you called in. This is a great perspective to get on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor
Komska, what do you make of that scenario that Don painted for us? Okay, so here was a legitimate election. He was there. He monitored it. And now there's another election coming up in May. What if Eastern Ukraine says, no, we really don't like that pro-Western slant and we reject these results? Is that possible?
Don just made a great point. And I think what happened since the last election is the extent of corruption that's grown by leaps and bounds and has been exposed for all the world to see as a consequence of the ongoing change and revolution in Ukraine. So we have seen Yanukovych, the former president, and his family, quote-unquote, so his most immediate relatives, his friends, profit. His family is running one of the biggest banks in Ukraine, and they have been profiting from the presidency on a very personal level. So what happened after Yanukovych's ouster is that his suburban villa, built in opulent style, complete with a restaurant that looks like a pirate ship, that was, you know, for those of you who watched the Colbert Report, that will ring a bell. You have seen pictures there, and is decorated with all sorts of knightly splendor, and has the kind of opulence that Ukrainians themselves have never seen and may not see in quite a few years to come. So the exposure of corruption that has taken place over the last 3-4 months, I should say, that will definitely play a role. And Yanukovych may not be able to garner as much support in the east of Ukraine as he would have 4 years ago. So I think this is something to keep in mind.
Wow. All right. Well, again, Don, thanks for that call. Did you want to jump in, Al?
Yeah, I was going to say that I would be extremely surprised to find out that anyone from whom I know who lives in the eastern part of Ukraine would still want Yanukovych to be back in power after all this massive exposure of the corruption which was taking place.
And again, you're from eastern Ukraine.
I'm from eastern Ukraine myself, right. So that's one thing, the scale of corruption which has been exposed. The other part is just the hard fact that at this point, Mr. Yanukovych is a fugitive, right? And he is someone who gave the order to kill Ukrainians.
The protesters in the streets.
The protesters at the streets. I'm not sure he can live with that fact as the president of Ukraine.
And by the way, you lost, Al, not a direct colleague, but someone that you work with in those street
protests. That's right. The company that my company works with, right, we are basically their clients. They lost one of their software engineers right there on Maidan. he was one of the protesters there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's real. You know, you hear about the headline, and then that's a real a contact of yours and so forth. Well, I'm sorry to hear about that. Anu, did you want to also jump in on this possibility of more instability? I hate to raise this, Dimitri, but our caller, Don, who's very knowledgeable, raised the idea of, you know, elections may not make this better.
Well, it's definitely going to be a very tough election. And but one thing I know, it's even when I talk to my friends who are running their own businesses in eastern part in Ukraine, they are not very passionate about recent events, but they also tired of level of corruption and in government on levels they have to deal with. And even like talking from directly to people who working as a businessman and entrepreneurs there, and reading about feelings of people with even bigger businesses, I think everybody just thinks that things got out of hand. And election's going to be tough. It's going to be very big differences between East and West. But the best thing that can happen is to make sure is those elections are legitimate. And even if people not entirely happy with results, they still accept them as fair enough. So that's the biggest hope, and probably reducing the power of president, so it wouldn't boil down to a single person.
Yeah, changing that up somewhat. Yeah. You know, you mentioned businesses, and I did want to ask you, Colonel Ingram, two things businesses hate, instability, political instability, but also corruption. And I thought Dimitri made a great point there. You know, businesses don't like the corruption of the Yanukovych government, but they also don't like the instability of his ouster. I wonder what the economic future of Ukraine is going to be if this crisis continues.
One has to recognize that in large measure the businesses in Ukraine and Russia thrive on corruption. The structure of the two societies as it's developed in the Soviet Union and what has come since then is in large measure reinforced by this. They got the oligarchs, and you got similar kind of people in the Ukraine too. So you have those folks, but you have the other kind of people, the entrepreneur folk that we're used to that would prefer not to live in that kind of environment. A particular point I'd like to raise, though, if the Russians believe that they're going to bring Ukraine back into the fold of Russia, or they're going to make them more Eastern, they have reinforced the attitude in Ukraine that they want to be sovereign, at least most of them do. And on top of that, they've reinforced the attitude that we do not want to be under the thumb of Russia. We would prefer to be much closer to the West. This is going to be a long-term loss from the standpoint of the Russians. I don't think they've perceived it carefully that way, but they have made it they've made an issue out of something which was relatively quiet, and they've made it an issue, and they've reinforced the attitude of the folks who are Westernized, are Western-oriented, even in Eastern regions, that direction. So I'm very curious to see what the election is going to come out to be, especially the parliamentary one, and how that's going to be reflected. Because I think the point that both of these folks have said here, Al and Dimitri, that their people are sort of concerned about what has happened, and they're most probably going to be more interested in being Ukrainian as opposed to being Russian.
So Putin's actions have only hardened Ukrainian nationalism. That's a point you made earlier,
I think so.
Let's take another call. And this is Vadim in Dover. Hi, Vadim. Thanks for waiting. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, good morning. I just want to tell my personal story because I am lost personally myself. My last name is Marchuk, which tells you that I'm Ukrainian. The story is very simple. My father is Ukrainian. My mother is Russian. My mother was born in Ukraine. My father was born in Russia. Since I was young, I spent a lot of time in the summertime on the Azov Sea with my grandparents. So I always felt at home. I felt Ukraine is my home. Having said that, I was born in Russia. I'm a Russian citizen. I always felt Russia is my home. And they're all brothers and sisters to me, and I have uncles. And it's just, I feel like I'm a hybrid, you know, of the two. And my mother's brother lives in Belarus, and I have also felt, you know, not as much as spent time there, but I also felt it's all home to me. And And now, if the blood sheds, I feel like I might lose my brothers and sisters. And I'm sure if I can go to my grandfather's grave in Ukraine. So,
you know, Vadim, yeah, this is such an important point, isn't it, Professor Komska? Because it's, you can't really say this person's Ukrainian, this person's Russian. I mean, the two countries have had such long, long, long ties and relationships and were together and apart and so forth. I'm glad you called, Vadim. Go ahead, Professor Komska. I'd love your thoughts.
Well, I'm very much there with Vadim in terms of being a hybrid myself. My mother is originally Russian, and we used to vacation there where I inevitably felt as Ukrainian. also, just because I had a slight accent in Russian, even though that was my mother tongue, and also because people let me know that I'm not from there. So the question for me now is I would like to just say upfront that I really see loud and clear, or hear loud and clear, that neither Russians nor Ukrainians want any bloodshed. People do not want war on either side of that border. But the question is ultimately also, where could one be a hybrid best? You know, what state can give? What state can be the best for people to practice their multiple identities that are not reducible to just one denominator, right? And I think Ukraine might be approaching that maybe more successfully than Russia. And I think that that's probably one of the strengths of the change, that it's been really insisting on the fact that it's possible. Coexistence is possible, and it's possible to have these hyphenated identities and practice them on a regular basis. There was on February 26th, two cities, Odessa in the south, which is Russian-speaking, and Lviv, my hometown in the west, which is Ukrainian-speaking, switched languages for the first time, in a way, and the entire city spoke Russian and Ukrainian, respectively, for just one day. So they kind of reversed the paradigm to show solidarity toward each other. And the reason that happened, because the new Ukrainian parliament, just the one that's now operating, has tried to repeal a Yanukovych-era law from 2012 that would allow minorities to have their language accepted as official, as a second official language, where the minority would be 10% of the population. And nobody liked that change. People wanted to protest against it. And I think that that's really a sign of a healthy democracy for me.
Yeah, and part of the feeling, again, that Vadim is expressing, that to say you're one or the other, it doesn't make sense in this part of the world for a
Absolutely.
Lot of people. It looks
Absolutely.
Like Dmitry wants to jump in. Go ahead, please. Yeah.
It was a very similar story for me. My father Russian, my mother is Ukrainian, and my mother-in-law lived with us. So at home, like for as long as I remember, we speak two languages at home. We speak Ukrainian to our grandmother. We speak Russian with our mother. It never been an issue. And right now, it just sickens me to see that this, all of a sudden, in 2 days, this issue try to be like drummed up as major problem that justifies foreign forces invasion.
And do you blame Putin for that, for creating divisions where there should not be?
I don't think I have friends from all parts of the country. When I was in college, some of the guys in my group, they were from Western Ukrainians, they had problems speaking Russians, and there were guys who were from eastern part of Ukraine who were not very good in Ukrainian. Still, I don't remember any cases when it would be an issue, let alone issues that justify using any kind of force.
Al?
Yeah, I was going to say that I lived in Ukraine for 25 years, and at that time and both now, and by the way, I go to Ukraine quite frequently, a couple of times a year, I would turn the TV on and I wouldn't even notice whether it's Russian or Ukrainian because, well, it wouldn't be even on the radar which language is used. That's how little of a problem it is there. That's one point. The other point, that language law or the repealing of that language law, it was actually vetoed by the interim president Turchinov, and that's a sign of a healthy democracy.
Here's an email that just came in from Polina in Nashua, and I'm going to throw this to you, Al and Dmitry, and maybe you too, Professor Komska. Polina says, I'm a Ukrainian living in Nashua. Now I feel a great need to unite with other Ukrainians living in the state. How can we do this? Any suggestions from your speakers? Dmitry?
Well, I don't want it to sound as a advertising, but my wife, she's started a business as like a Russian school language, and people from all former Soviet republics, like from Ukraine, many of them from Ukraine and from Russia, they meet there.
And what is the name of the school in
It's just School of Russian Language, Literature and Art, and they can look it up, and if they want to meet people, there'll be plenty of them.
Okay.
There.
Well, and good luck to all of you and your family and friends in Ukraine. We'll hope that this resolves peacefully. That's what we can hope for right now. Colonel Ingram, it was good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Appreciate it.
Colonel Lionel Ingram, lecturer in political science and foreign policy at UNH. Professor Komska, thank you also for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Professor Yulia Komska, assistant professor of German at Dartmouth College. Her forthcoming book is The Iron Curtain, The Cold War's Quiet Border. Al Bamiyar, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
And also Dmitry Goryanov, thank you also for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Nate Graby. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, part two of our series on the teaching profession, Educating Our Educators, a look at how we prepare our teachers. After criticism that credentialing standards have been lax, many states, including New Hampshire, are trying to raise the bar. For example, some say more in-classroom experience is key. But there are challenges to such changes. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show. Next at 10 o'clock, New Hampshire weather, sunshine for this morning, clouding up this afternoon, highs low to mid-20s. Cloudy tonight, chance of evening snow showers for the North Country, lows from single numbers north ranging teens in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the City of Claremont. Information about Claremont's investments in sustainable growth at claremontnh.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It is 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The standoff in Ukraine continues. Russian President Vladimir Putin says his country reserves the right to use force to protect Russian citizens living in Ukraine. He calls the current government in Ukraine unconstitutional and says the Russian takeover in Crimea is legal. Russian troops still surround